Welcome, everybody, to Season 2, Episode 16 of The Psychologists Are In. I am Maggie Lawson.
And I'm her podcast partner in crime, Timothy Albertson.
And today, we are talking about the Season 2 finale. Time flies when you're talking about pineapple goodness. Today, we are joined by, we just love him so much, the incredible Steve Franks, to talk about one of our favorite episodes, Sean and Gus of the Dead. Enjoy. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Maggie.
How you doing today, Tim? You look great.
Thanks, Maggie. So do you. And I actually got to see you yesterday.
I know. Yesterday
was
in human form.
Huge
bonus day. It's always a bonus when we get to see each other.
And your amazing new glasses looked even better in person than on the virtual visuals.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I love them. I actually really, really love them. My vision. Well, I probably shouldn't talk about this on the podcast.
No, you should. This is exciting.
Really interesting to everyone. No, my vision has gotten significantly worse over the last 2 years. So I'm just very happy to see. And I love these new glasses. And look at us. We're all wearing them. Okay. How happy, excited, lucky are we to have Steve back in a very busy time for him? There's so much, you know, going on and graduations and award ceremonies for your son and everything else. And we're so happy that you're here to talk about Sean and Gus of the Dead. We always just feel so lucky when we get to have you.
I can't believe we're already at the season finale of Season 2.
Insane.
And the second season of The Psychologists Are In, a rewatch podcast.
It's crazy to me. It's just crazy to me how it's flying. Steve, I also have to point out your glasses, since we're all wearing our glasses.
I love those. Are really good.
I wanted to get the clear frames for a while, but then Chris Henze, our other executive producer, had them, and I didn't want to be a copycat. And then we were like twins with the clear frame, even though he doesn't own that look. But I finally had to break down because I just need it. What I really like, though, is the frameless, which is, of course, not in style. But when you're 6'8", there's very few things that are in style that are either made for you or fit you. So,
well, look, this kind of gives you the best of both worlds because it's a clear frame, so it doesn't. But I think you can handle a Tim frame as well.
Oh yeah, no, I would love that. And Tim just oozes so much Cary Grant in the 80s charisma, right? When Cary Grant went with the thicker frames, he can pull all of that off. I think I could do, but I wouldn't do it as well.
I think you'd be just great, but I have to agree with you that nobody does it like Tim.
Yeah, no, that's true. Nice.
Yeah.
And gee, who helped me pick out these frames? Oh, Maggie Lawson.
Oh, just in New York when we were there for upfronts. Right?
For the awesome. Yeah, it was for the psych upfronts.
Yeah, we were just there for the psych upfronts and we were like cruising around. And what was that, 14th and 7th, I think, that the Salma Scott is on?
That's a hell of a memory.
I remember that corner very well. There's a subway station right there. Anyway.
Was that when we had the party out? Is this too inside baseball right now for everybody? But I think this is what your fans probably want to hear about.
They love the inside baseball.
We had the party out on the Hudson, right? The Hudson, that's a river.
Yes.
That's a river in New York City, yes.
Was it at the High Line? Or it was out that way by the water. Oh my gosh, yes, I'm remembering this.
I have a tremendous picture of me hugging Tim so very tightly with the Brooklyn Bridge behind me. Now I'm showing how little I know about New York. So whatever is that, I don't know, maybe it's not even the Brooklyn Bridge. I know it's not the Golden State or the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yeah, yeah, the Golden Gate.
See, my lack of bridge knowledge is really trouble. Golden Gate Bridge, no.
No, it wasn't that one. That one we know for sure. But if you can find that picture, that would be a very fun post. God, we had such a good time during those trips to New York and those upfronts.
So fun.
And when we went a little too much of a good time.
One time, Tim had a little too much of a good time.
Alcohol poisoning.
And Maggie had to drop off many treats for him to try to get well.
you risking me that day?
I was like, Pedialyte, I'll run to the store and get a Pedialyte. And I left it outside his door. We were supposed to go to a museum, very on theme for today's podcast.
I really like how you tie that in.
Yeah, there we go. Because we're talking Shaun and Gus of the Dead. Well, hang on. Before we get into the episode, Steve, I'm going to put you on the spot a little. Where was your head at? Like, here we get to so the end of season two, I feel like it wasn't until season three that we would know before we wrapped if we were picked up. I still think, or did we know at the end of season two that we were coming back already? Like, did you already have the heads up?
I don't think so. I think they never told us in advance. They always made it sound like we're losing so much money on this show. My God. But we saw the ratings. We knew we were doing really well. I think we were pretty confident that we were coming back, which is why I added a cliffhanger to the end of the episode. As if the ending of this episode doesn't have enough stuff going on. Then all of a sudden it's like, introduce Shaun's mom. Oh, fantastic.
But, I remember reading that. I was like, oh, I get chills just thinking about it. It was such a good cliffhanger. I was like, oh, he knows what he's doing. We got to come back now.
It's so funny, though, because what you want to do with the season is you want to wrap everything up and you want closure. That's the natural instinct. And then you start, and then the next year is about something else. But for some reason, it's like, well, there's got to be a cliffhanger. This thing's got to cause people to tune in. And we didn't want to shoot anybody yet. We would do that later. And
now, Steve, let me ask, sorry, was this your directorial debut?
It was.
Holy crud, what an amazing episode to knock it out of the park with.
Well, thank you so much, Tim. And it was on the pilot. The director of our pilot, Michael Engler, told me at one point, he goes, what you got to do is at some point you just say, I'm going to direct an episode. And I go, well, they're not going to let me direct an episode. He goes, oh, they will. and so he goes, you know, and then just direct one a year. And so I didn't do it in the first season because it was just so crazy. And then the second season, I'm going to do it. And then, of course, it has to be the last episode. I have to do all of my other job, which was, we were writing all the episodes and post and all that stuff. So we had to get way ahead down in Manhattan Beach where everything else was. And then I got to come up and play with you guys. And I just say it's one of the most exciting, terrifying, life-affirming experiences of my life to get to sit at the director's chair. And I watched it twice now so I could have some sort of insight on what we've done. And it still fills me with joy. I mean, I should know all these jokes and all of that, but it was just so much fun. And what I really noticed out of this episode, and this is beyond your question, Tim, is how much you guys really just gave so much extra in this episode. And I'm sure it wasn't for me. I'm sure you just wanted to go home, but I'm grateful regardless.
It was always for you, Steve.
It was wonderful.
It was wonderful. And I want to add too, it is such a joy because you're in such joy when you're like, it doesn't feel like work because you have so much fun and you're so into it and you're so excited that it just, all of us feel that. And every day is so fun and so exciting. I mean, the movies too, it's just, and this episode, I feel like you feel it. You can just feel the fun. You had some shots. I called really flowy walk and talks that are really hard to do. And they were beautiful. I could not believe, I can't believe this was your first time directing.
Well, I was clearly the first time director in that I was overdoing everything. and specifically those walk and talks. We shot that in the Museum of Vancouver, which is attached to the McMillan Space Center, which will come into play later as we go through the episode.
I thought that was the Space Center. I recognize that sort of 50s brick wall in the back.
Yes, exactly. And there's a moment where they're standing outside the loading dock where Shaun and Gus in the background behind them is the actual planetarium where the first scene of Gus and Salina meeting was shot. And the first day of shooting on Psych the Movie 1. And so much of our history took place right around there. And I used to, I loved that building and I really wanted to, we did the space episode From the Earth to the Starbucks.
Starbucks, yeah.
And I knew I wanted to go back there, and I knew I wanted to do a mummy episode. And so I actually, this is one of the many occasions where I bought an annual pass, and I went in there and I sat there and I wrote that episode inside the Museum of Vancouver. much of it. And
that's amazing.
And plotted out like those long walk and talks. I tried to go to the back of the building and walk as far back as I could and see how long we could make it. And it goes back to the emergency exit where you guys come in, and it tracks as far as we can. And then pretty soon we're in the lobby if it had gone any farther. Just because I just felt I was just dying to direct, and I had to do as much as humanly possible.
You can tell, like, there's even a point when in the very beginning when Tim and I come in, where I think I like split off and then I come back around like into the shot. I was like, wow, this was cool. This was looking very good.
Yeah, zipping around, and then I meet McNabb for the paper. I do remember that being just in a really, really complicated walk and talk. But to Maggie's point about your enthusiasm, now we say that Maggie is our resident ray of sunshine. You are like our resident supernova of sunshine, if that makes sense. Because your positivity, much like Maggie's sunshine and positivity, you got on set, Steve, and like we know that it's all going to be good because if there's something like we're hitting a problem, your enthusiasm is just going to like run roughshod through that problem and nothing's going to get you down.
Well, you know, and it's just always, it comes from you guys, and it comes from the energy, and this is fun. This is so fun. It's someone's giving us the amount of money that they gave us to make these episodes, which I would never tell because, of course, it's a top secret thing. But we're
$47 Canadian.
But we get this certain amount of money to play around and to tell these really silly stories. And Tim, I when we did that walk and talk, I have a very vivid memory of you. And actually, we're gonna have to beep out what you said to me when I showed you the walk and talk, because I had written a speech that I thought would fill in that amount of space. The entire case is laid out. And I went and walked it back and forth. The poor people that were in the Museum of Vancouver in 2008 or whenever this was, was seeing me walk around saying both of your lines, going back and forth. But what I didn't realize is I was walking way too slow, and that you guys would have to walk at a normal pace. You have to talk so fast. And so I kept telling you, faster, faster, faster. And finally you said, and this is where we're going to have to be, but you said, Jesus, man. So, Jesus, man, what do you need me to inject in the which I always thought was an interesting
oh, that metaphor. That is very funny, and that's really good.
If you go back and watch, I mean, it's, and the worst thing for you, Tim, is it's pipe. It's, you're not laying out one case. You're laying out the backdrop for two cases at the same time without the audience knowing it, or maybe they're completely onto us from the beginning. But, Maggie, we had to have you spin off at one point because it was hard to hold both of you in the same shot. And it was all for the sort of, the technical aspect of it. And I'm sure the crew is like, who in the world is this guy? Because I go, so we're going to do this entire building as a walk and talk on day three or whatever it was. And it was early in the shoot.
Banting was not probably wasn't our steady cam operator yet.
No. And here's a complaint about the streamers. It's like, I tried to watch to see the credits, to see who the steady cam operator was. And I was like, This isn't an Eric Norlin year, right? Or was it still Don Snyder?
Oh,
In terms of art director.
Oh, I thought it was Eric.
I think so, because I know Don. She left at the end of one, and because she had to go back, and then I think we went right to Eric, because I remember that, and much of that stuff was built. I mean, I'm sure we'll get to all of that stuff. I wanted to go back and see, but there's no way that I've been able to figure out, and as you can tell, I'm not good with technology, that to be able to actually see the credits of the people who spent the 12 hours on set, you know, hopefully 12 hours, and put all the time into it. So that's a little bit of a letdown. But Tim, don't worry, because your credit is always, always visible. And
oh, I checked, there. Believe me.
I want to comment too, Tim, your hair was very good in this episode. It's a little longer.
It had gotten a little longer. I think I can't remember when I was buzzing. If it was at the end of season one, I buzzed all my hair off. Or I know it was super short for the baseball episode.
Yeah, it was tight. It wasn't the tightest ever. Was at the beginning of eight.
This is really what people are tuning in for.
It's very interesting.
No, this is all good. And by the way, here's another fun little bit of trivia about the long shot. Is there's a shot later that's a long walk and talk with Sean and Gus, and they're going through the museum at night. That shot, I may have been a first-time director, but I'm a really good producer in terms of time and money. So that shot is literally the reverse of the route you guys took. And all we did is I set it up, because it takes so long, the light. So we lit it. We did your scene. Thank you, guys. You went home. We brought in James and Dulé. We turned off some lights so it looked like night. And they went the opposite way. And since they were going the opposite way, it looked like a totally different place.
That is brilliant and very time-saving.
It's also countering me, the writer, probably writing a script that was 7 pages too long. So, but it's funny you mentioned, so much fun.
Laying pipe in that first speech, because I remember watching it and just the phrase came into my head of like, wow, I was laying some pipe in this one.
You're so good. And I know we're going to get to it, but for me, you know, there's certain things in the scene where the chief is telling everyone she's going to step down. It's so great. And there's so much going on. It's like Maggie's losing her mentor and Vic is leaving the job that she's wanted. And Sean knows he has a plan in motion and he's delaying and Gus is feeling the emotion. But for me, that scene is about Lasseter seeing blood on the tracks. And yeah. Like, it's all about, you have the opening, your dream job is right there. And you just keep trying to figure out how to bring up. Did they mention me? They didn't mention me, right? Oh God, it's Tim. It is such fine work in subtle, hilarious. There's so much going on that you do in here.
It's very subtle. Yeah,
interesting, because you both said subtle. Subtle's not normally a word that is used on me in acting. So thank you. I'll take it.
That's what makes this so good, is you're hiding. You're not doing a very good job of hiding it, but you're trying to.
Of my hopeful glee. Yes.
Yes. Yes, exactly. All right. Should we dive into the episode and then just.
Oh, I thought we were done.
only if Maggie, I'm ready to dive in if you're ready to podcast the shit out of it.
Tim, I have never been more ready to podcast the shit out of it. What about you?
Never not ready, lady.
Yep. What about you, Steve?
I'm ready as I've ever been to podcast. I mean, to podcast beyond the podcasting of all time.
I think he wins.
No.
I think that's we're going to have to do that. Podcasting.
The bar has been set high, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, it has. Okay. The finale. Oh my gosh. Wait. We'll get there. Okay. I'm excited too. I really want to ask you about the cliffhanger. Okay. Episode 16, the season finale of season 2 of Psych, Sean and Gus of the Dead. And Gus,
you get extra points for this, extra credit points for this title, Steve.
Thank you very much. It was there for me. And it was so easy. Although, you know, Sean of the Dead is about the zombie apocalypse. So it's a little bit of a push with it being Mummy, but the titles are always our favorites. Sometimes we couldn't quite find something that was super clever, but some of these really hold up. And I love this one because it's so perfect. And a movie that I just absolutely love through and through.
Love. Okay. Pineapple sighting. There is a pineapple in the kitchen when Henry is cleaning. Really?
Oh, there is? I thought it was I thought it was at the very end. We were probably not as focused on it at this point because there used to, it was always a rule that there would be one pineapple and you had to make sure. But sometimes in the first season, like because we would send the cuts up to Vancouver, we wouldn't realize that sometimes they would just cut the pineapple out.
Oh my God, that's so good.
This is the other thing that happened. I think this goes back to the second episode, the first one we shot. The debut of Maggie, but I think we were in that hotel, and Bo Diddley was sitting in the hotel waiting to go, right. And they went and got a release and they filmed him, and James did an improv about Bo Diddley, and it's like, oh my God, this is so cool. And then we're going back to edit, and they're like, we have to get 30 seconds out, or like, no, it's like we got to get 12 seconds out. And they're like, hey, we can do it. You won't even notice anything. And me in my infinite greenness said, oh yeah, go ahead, do it. It'll be fine. They cut the Bo Diddley thing.
Oh my God. Really?
No. Yeah. So Bo Diddley never appeared. It exists somewhere, but I don't know if anybody could find it.
But anyways,
we almost had Bo Diddley on the show for nothing.
Being in the lobby and seeing him and somebody going was like, please someone go ask Bo if he'll be in the background of a shot.
Yeah, and he referenced him, and it was you got to pay attention at all times. That's the rule. Yeah, but you learn these things. You learn these things as you go.
That's a good one. Okay, cold open. Henry and Madeline watch a scary movie at night with Sean sneakily watching in the background. Henry creeps up on him asking why he isn't in bed yet. Sean explains he got scared from the movie and he couldn't sleep. Henry then gives him a beautiful yes.
Ding, ding. Thinking this was going to be he'd be watching The Mummy, he's actually watching Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yes.
You want to know why, Tim?
Because it's in the Universal. It must be the Universal Library.
The only thing we could, it's one of the things we could get very cheap. And I had to change Henry's speech because his speech was originally, at one point it was, I wanted it to be Night of the Living Dead. That was my original plan. And it was going to be about decomposing bodies and all that. And so then it ended up, we finally locked up Creature from the Black Lagoon. Hey, great. That's a great movie. And so it's a recognizable title. So there is this sort of weird amalgamation of like a lot of different things in Henry's speech, but Corbin still sells it like magnificently. It's really funny how sweet he is about bodies exploding and all of that. And the other funny thing about this scene is too, is Sean is watching from an alcove that cannot exist in the physical world. We had to build that out because otherwise he would be at the kitchen. He wouldn't have been able to see the TV. Oh my God. There wasn't a place that we could do the angle. So we built out a non-existent space in the realm of the set that Sean could kind of duck back there and look around the corner to.
Oh, that's great. That's great. It's such a sweet moment. Okay, so, well, we kind of talked about this. Henry gives him a beautiful parenting pep talk about how scary movies are fake, refusing to leave out any gory details about actual crimes he's witnessed on the job. Cut back to present day, where Lasseter and Juliet walk around a museum. Here's one of those shots. They meet with the assistant curator, where Lassie has a not-so-hot take. And Juliet sternly puts him back in his place. Yeah, we are a little bickery. I like bickery Juliet Lasseter.
I love that one of the first lines we have, the first exchanges in this episode is about me and coffee.
Uh-huh.
Because I'm cranky because I've had my coffee yet.
Yeah. It's 4 a.m.
Yeah, it's 4 a.m. And the fact that Sean's already up and Juliet's going to call him and he thinks that it's a butt dial the other kind. Sorry, it wasn't a butt dial.
booty call for sure.
That's it. That's yes, what we're looking
yes,
for.
Yes, yes, yes.
And that I refer to the museum as not even the one downtown, of course, meaning the art museum where we always shoot.
That was a very funny line. I wrote that down. Not even the art museum, not even the museum downtown.
Yeah.
I just love that Lasseter knows his museums. Okay, so a 3,000-year-old mummy is missing. The curator confidently mentions she wants Sean's help on the case, where the camera then cuts to Sean secretly taking pictures of a man and woman walking back to their apartment at 4 a.m. Back at the museum, Sean walks around the room critiquing everything. He even has his classic, I've heard it both ways moment.
That was nice.
That was very nice. Sean notices handprints on the mummy display and footprints on the ground that can only mean one thing. The mummy walked out on its own.
What?
Cue the theme song.
It's really magical what James does when he gets there. And that recreation is like, I didn't even remember it being that good. It's one of the better spooky, fun recreations that we've ever done.
And I wrote spooky down in my notes too. Like it really kind of builds that. It's different. It's a little different psych.
And there's this great moment where, and it happens twice in here. I was always, our composers, John Wood and Adam Cohen, I was always pushing them to do more John Williams. And there's something that's so out of Raiders of the Lost Ark when you see all that, with all the mummy stuff happening, it was pushing the boundaries of how much of a tribute you can do to John Williams. And just, I love it so much that we have a world we can build and have that kind of music. And if only we could have an orchestra, you know, we got it once, but it was
for
really,
the musical, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just for our musical. By the way, this is also, Tim, I hope I'm not taking your job. This is the birth of Bruton Gaster. It's the first time that we hear that. And then the other thing
is
the first time we've heard Bruton Gaster. And
psych first, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
I know of another first as well.
Oh, what is
think,
that?
I think it is. It's way later, though, but the 11-point turn.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's the birth of that as well. And then the dinosaur Zippy was named after my sister's cat that lived to 23 years old. So, Zippy is immortalized. And that cat, it might still be alive today. Nobody knows. It would never pass away.
I know you guys heard me talking a lot about vertigo, this like recent bout of vertigo that I had. I've now talked to several people who have vertigo or suffer from vertigo. It is crazy because you're kind of afraid to do anything because you never know when it is going to hit. But you've got to check out Relief Band, not just for vertigo, but for a million other things. But this is where I found it very helpful. Relief Band is the number one FDA-cleared anti-nausea wristband that has been clinically proven to quickly relieve and effectively prevent nausea and vomiting associated with motion sickness, anxiety, migraines, hangovers, morning sickness, chemotherapy, I'm going to throw in vertigo, and so much more. How it works is Relief Band stimulates a nerve in the wrist that travels to the part of the brain that controls nausea. Then it blocks the signal your brain is sending to your stomach telling you that you are sick. It's like the name says. It is legitimately a band you wear on your wrist to give you relief from nausea, and you change the intensity depending on how you were feeling to make it stronger or weaker. It's that simple. You guys, it really is that simple. It's very, very, very easy to set up and very easy to use. And to be honest, I never even had to use the higher settings. Even the lower settings were good enough for me. So I would imagine even going to those higher settings, you're like good to go. Also, Relief Band just released their newest model, Relief Band Sport. The Sport is waterproof and has an extended battery life and can even attach to your Apple or Android watch. So if you are finally taking that summer trip that's been on the calendar since 2020, as lots of people are, I have got good news. Right now, you can join the over 100,000 Relief Band users with an exclusive offer just for the psychologists or in listeners. If you go to reliefband.com and use promo code PINEAPPLE, you will receive 20% off plus free shipping and a no questions asked 30-day money back guarantee. Remember, it's better to have a Relief Band and not need it than to need it and not have it. So head to reliefband, reliefband.com and use our promo code PINEAPPLE for 20% off plus free shipping. Back at the station, Chief Vic mentions that she's stepping down as interim chief on Friday. Good old Lassie is thrilled because that means the job is open.
Sorry, I got to interject. We made it like not even 45 seconds into the scene before we get a Kirsten Nelson, Chief Vic, collar pop.
It is a collar pop. She looks great. Her hair looks really good. It's very, very she looks very sweet. And when she tells us, I love that the first thing is like, I think, do I say, you can't do that? Or something. I have this just like immediate childish reaction of like, no, you can't leave. You're not leaving me. It's very, very sweet.
And she has such quiet strength in that scene. It's, you know, it's she does that so, so well. And there's so many great moments with her in this. For me, the end when she's on the phone and she's getting the call. And of course, we'll get to that.
But so
her,
great.
Her, okay, she's going to take the job. It's just, it's totally delightful.
It's very good. She has a grace.
Yes, exactly.
Like a grace and an elegance about her. Okay, at the psych office, Sean watches security videos from the museum. Sean and Gus then arrive back at the museum where Gus has a slight tantrum about the plaque leaving out his photo and spelling his name correctly. Yeah.
Back to the scene where Vic is saying she's leaving and Lester's very exciting and hoping that he's up for the job. And I say something very insensitive. The O'Hara head slap was, that made me LOL, as the kids say. Speaking of subtle, I appreciated you being subtle with that hit.
Yeah. Well, you know. I'm still me.
In the world of psych, there's nothing better than giving you guys competing agendas. If everybody has a different agenda, the magic just happens. You don't. Yeah. You just get out of the way. And that was my job in that scene, just to get out of the way, because everybody had wheels spinning in different directions. And it's so fun when you can. I mean, and it's hard to line a story up where everybody has something separate going on. So when you can steer all the stories in that direction, it's just really, really fun.
That scene sums it up, I feel like, as well. Like that is such a pure psych multi-agendaed scene.
Uh-huh. Yes, exactly.
Okay, so Gus has a slight tantrum about the plaque. Oh, leaving out his photo and spelling his name incorrectly. It is then revealed why Sean hasn't told Gus about the case yet. It's simply because Gus thinks he'll be haunted by the mummy. Sean and Gus test out the museum's camera system by running and hiding. You know what that means? Security cam montage. Devin, that's so cute. But this was so fun.
Oh my God. I was so excited to, like I said, first time director, I threw the kitchen sink into this episode. I knew I wanted to do a montage. And I love that Wilco song that we use.
So great.
So I got to point out one specific beat in this montage. When the boys are talking back and forth on the phone, Andrew Lay says, I saw a guy with a pancake butt. And James says, I do not have a pancake butt. And who walks past but a cameo by our beloved Steve Franks in his own Hitchcockian cameo.
And I love this, like this blue steely kind of look you give as you go by. You look back like it's very tough and cool, and it's a very good cameo.
Thank you. I don't know if I'm misremembering it, but I feel like I had the idea to jump in the scene while we were rolling. And I know we did it twice. It wasn't something I planned out. Like on my other cameos, some of them I had to very secretly secretly plot out for months and months, like the musical. But I think I went in and ran in and did it. And then we had to do it one more time to reframe for my ridiculously tall height. Half of my head was probably gone.
It was the first Steve Franks cameo. It certainly wasn't the last.
No, certainly not. No, are you kidding? I always wanted to be in there, but I was operating with a level of restraint even I'm surprised by.
So you were a chimney sweep in the musical, right?
Yeah, I was the chimney sweep in the musical, and James made me a 8 hours worth of makeup for a zombie later too.
Yeah, everybody, you Henzi, everybody did.
Yeah, and also the other moment in that's Dulé's mom, right? Who's stopped bothering that lady?
Oh yeah, that's right. She's in there too.
Yeah, she was on the site on the set earlier that day. So that sequence is just chock full of inside information about it. The funny thing is that when James is holding up the carpet to walk, it actually worked. It was a joke. I was like, can we get a square of carpet and we'll do it? And then he did it and I go, holy crap, that actually worked. So I actually had to luckily we were shooting Dulé's side of it later. So I actually wrote in Dulé saying, actually that kind of works.
Yeah, because it did. It was good.
It was so fun to film. Like I said, I love, if you ever go to Vancouver, and you should go repeatedly, go down to the MOV, the Museum of Vancouver, and visit both the McMillan Space Center and of course the Museum of Vancouver, which has all sorts of things. Tim, you know, you have a drinking game that you introduce every week. There is a fantastic new drinking game I would like to, if you will so allow it, to the to the rotation. In this episode, when they're walking through the Santa Barbara or the Seador Center Museum of History, if you look, every time you see the word Vancouver on one of the plaques that we can't move, there's quite a lot of them. You should take a drink because there's center spelled S-C-E-N-T-R-E, the proper British way, or but you see pieces of the word Vancouver so many times that you should definitely do this drinking game with something with a low alcohol content.
It makes me want to go back and watch it now. Watch all those parts. That's so funny. I always try to spot that.
A little Vancouver insider. So as Steve was saying, if you're going up to Vancouver with kids, or you just like museums on your own. So there's the Space Museum right there, and which is right near the Maritime Museum. Because the season one, I lived right around the corner from these spots.
Oh, yeah. You had a whole summer where you lived in Kits, right? Or was it 2 years?
I think every summer, pretty much, we would.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, it's so beautiful down in that area. And you know, it's funny because the writers used to accuse me of in my episodes, just writing places that I wanted to visit as a tourist. So, or downtown in, you know, exterior Stanley Park day. And then Andy would always say, he would think that I was gauging my entire episode around where my hotel was. But for me, it's like, you know, I like that. I also punish myself by, more than any other writer in the history of the show, writing exterior, woods, night, which is a terrible, terrible thing, which we're going to do
the
later
worst
in this episode.
And then we end up in the GVRD an hour away on the night shoot. And yep.
Floating
which is
up
always
giant zeppelins that are just these lighted things. But it looks so good on film that I love it. I love being out there. And if it happens to be, you know, 3 degrees Celsius, then so be it.
No, I agree with you. There is something really magical that happens in night shoots, I feel like, because it's that time of day where no one else is working. You're like past the workday and like you're just out. And most of the time you have to shoot at night for exterior. So you're usually outside. You're like in whether the woods or walking on a street or whatever. You're under the stars. And I feel like there's always a camp vibe that happens.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because we're so far north, it doesn't get dark until really, really, really late. So if we're doing a night shoot, it's really, really, really late for us.
And it's generally a Friday because it's going to screw up your whole schedule if you do it earlier in the week. But you know, we only do it once in a while. Whereas you see all these CW shows that every single night when we're coming home from our shoot, 9:30 at night, the trucks are arriving.
Starting.
And you're like, oh my gosh. So
yeah.
I love it, and I have to apologize to everybody who had to work in the middle of the woods. But to me, I was giddy like a school child when I was out there with and there's always fog, as much fog as I could pump into the as they'll allow me in the GVRD.
We love it. We love it, though. I feel like some of my favorite moments are those nights we get out there. Everybody's a little giddy. Everybody gets a little delirious. Everybody, it's beautiful. I feel like a lot of the shots I have from episodes on my phone are just taken of like the woods and a little bit of light coming through and the fog. You can create such a cool world that way.
And then in between shots, we'd all run to the warming tent because we're all freezing. I have a picture of us, of us sitting in the warming tent in front of a heater, and my pants are soaking wet because we're in the woods and it's been wet and raining because it's Vancouver. They're actually starting to steam.
These are the moments, though. Like, this is what we remember. It's so special. Okay, where are we? Okay, pancake butt during the montage. Yes, and we get a little, we get an actorial debut of the one and only Steve Franks. After all of the lights shut off in the museum, Sean reveals that he and Gus are locked in for the night. As Gus attempts to leave, Sean notices there's a camera outside on the grass. Then Jules calls Sean, letting them know that the missing security guard has a rental car that just so happens to be parked right next to the blueberry outside. That was eerie. It was
a triple punch in on the gray GMC truck. I think I was looking for a car that was even more like not distinctive, because the GMC trucks are wonderful, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But that was the thing that had the big letters on it. We had to know that the guy was in the building with him.
So, Steve, I have a question for you. During this montage, there's many references to Red Robin between the boys. So I was wondering if that was
a product integration?
That was a paid endorsement for Red Robin?
Do you want to know what's hilarious? Is it was not. because the fact that Sean is just saying it's weird that her favorite restaurant is Red Robin. And I think we had something with Chili's going on. But here's the thing. When my family comes up, there was a Red Robin on the corner upstairs that was like, and my parents would come up, and my dad is not what they call an adventurous eater. So I had to have very safe selections. So we went to that Red Robin a lot. And I'm a huge fan of the Whiskey River Chicken Burger. By the way, Red Robin should be paying you guys right now.
Oh, and it's on, totally. It's on Robson, right in the corner from the Sutton place.
It was right across where where there used to be Catacorner Starbucks. Yeah, now below it's Artizia is the name of it.
Artiziano, yeah.
Is that what it is?
I think Artigiano.
Oh, no, that's a coffee place. Isn't that? That's like
Aritzia?
A weird... Yeah, maybe that's it.
Aritzia,
like
the clothing. It's a block long now.
Oh, my
God.
Yes,
and it's my favorite place to shop in the whole world.
Okay.
Yeah.
Look at us. Wow, we should write a book about traveling to Vancouver.
We should.
I do have to give a personal shout out to my youngest daughter, Nora, because she was always up there. Her birthday's in August, much like Maggie Lawson's. So we were never in town in LA for her birthdays. So being the second kid, if those of you who have second kids, you know, they always get the fuzzy end of the lollipop. So for Lily, our oldest, we always had these amazing birthday parties back home. And she would get cake on the beach, on Kids Beach. So she got like an enamel cake. But there was one year we went all out and we did a little birthday party at Red Robin with like some of the neighborhood kids we knew in the neighborhood.
So how about that? Red Robin stepping up.
Hey, we have Red Robin in Kentucky. Do we have them in California?
There are. There's one not too far from us.
You
don't see them quite as much.
I went there quite a bit when we were in Vancouver as well. Just like some quick, you know, comfy food.
Well, and the funny thing too is we said it once, and I think I must have thrown it into the thing of what's a funny, and like for me it's like I don't want to be negative, I don't want to like slam some restaurant I don't like, so I thought okay, well, you know, it's curious that she would want to go to Red Robin. But then James didn't like the blow to the scene, so we sat there and riffed on it, and I think we came up with on the fly, what do they have at Red Robin? And he sold it so well that
what are they actually serving at Red Robin?
That's so good.
I always said in the history of psych, because the guys are such consumers and fans of everything, that we gave away more free integrations than the history of all other television.
We're that nice. We did, yes. Okay, so we've had, right, I call Sean. Okay, so the truck is parked next to the Blueberry. Sean drops his phone and it breaks, which means they are locked in overnight with no phones and a potential convict on the loose. Walking around the museum.
Spooky.
So good. Sean realizes the Confederate flag has dust on the bottom of the frame and that there's a cracked gun in the case. How peculiar. Sean notices a fridge as well and opens it only to find the missing security guard dead inside.
And you know what that would mean.
So that must mean that the security guard was
murdered.
Correct. Sean and Gus then arrive at a graveyard.
I'm sorry.
I answered to both. I answered to both.
There is a first, another first right here. And maybe it's not. It's probably, no, it's not a first. But in James's long history of doing something very simple that he makes seem 1,000 times harder than it is in the real world. And that's opening the fridge.
It's the best.
Just a latch you pull down on.
Yes, I realized he also did that in the dinosaur episode, which would have to be before this because the dinosaur is the catalyst and to that. So certainly it would be there. But
funny.
I loved if you just go back and watch James's face, he's trying to just pull the simple handle on on an old fridge.
It's a great bit. It's so funny. It's always funny. Juliet mentioned security guard was strangled to death, but the hand was wrapped in cloth, which means a mummy did it, obviously.
Obvs. I think one of my favorite storytelling devices is that it's often the third act break when the impossible is supposedly what's happening.
It's a mummy.
Yeah, it's so much. It's so much fun. And whenever we can get to that, it's glorious. But also what's really fun here too is the hard cut counterpoint where Sean promises Gus, you're not going to the museum. There's not going to be anything spooky. A hard cut to Laster having a body exhumed from a graveyard.
It's so good.
The casket coming out.
Yes, exactly. It's just tremendous. And and I learned something very important once again as first time director, and because I end up writing often in cemeteries. And it's very, very, you have to be very respectful when you shoot at a cemetery. And we shot at an actual cemetery on the way up to the GVRD. So I can imagine the schedule was tied to the night shoots, which, by the way, I also didn't write you guys into the night stuff in the woods. So so that was at least a little bit thoughtful of me.
I love it.
But what I realized later, and this is when you all have your own television shows, is you don't need to go to a real cemetery. You put three fake headstones on any grass area in the deep background, and everybody thinks you're at a cemetery, and it's 1,000 times easier. So,
but I love your authenticity, Steve.
Yes, exactly.
I love it. We gotta, you know, it's sometimes you just gotta really feel it. You gotta feel where you are.
Tim, do you remember when they were pulling that coffin out of the ground? It was swinging around so wildly, but you wanted to be like literally guiding it out, like it was, you're the crane operator yourself. I remember, because I'm once again, safety is like such an important thing on sets naturally, but I get so nervous, and you guys always want to just like, oh yeah, throw me in there, hold on, I'll be fine, I'll go and do it. And so I was imagining,
cut to Maggie going, Tim, stop, Tim, you're gonna hurt yourself.
Every time I'm like, bubble wrap this guy, please. If yes,
as you walk up, you're in a dusty rose, you're in a blush pink top, mm-hmm. and I have a new variation on a drinking game.
Oh, nice.
So I think previously one of the drinking games was you take a sip of whatever beverage you want. Could be apple juice, although it's not nearly as fun. On the Pepto pink. So now it's called Pepto drink.
So it's just Pepto drink now.
So you have to drink Pepto when it happens?
No, you have to take a shot whenever Maggie's in Pepto pink.
Oh, okay, okay.
It's been sort of long running.
It sounds like a distant relative, Dusty Rose could pass.
Yeah, I think when we do the next psych movie, somebody has to say the words Pepto pink, and that will be self-reflexive right back to this thing.
This whole thing. I love it. This was a Tim. That was a Tim. Tim came up with the Pepto pink.
Yeah.
And now it's a thing.
I think you and I are in the red family this entire episode, because I'm in a red tie like the entire episode.
Yeah.
And I don't think you ever changed out of that. Well, maybe you're pretty much in that blush rosé. Shall we say rosé?
Rosé all day.
Something you're familiar with.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I think you're familiar with rosé.
Yes. I like
it's a type of wine.
Okay. All right. Moving on. Now we are back at Henry's home.
I was very proud of coming up with Pepto drink.
Pepto drink is I think that's the name of the drinking game. Although it could be very confusing. It might be Pepto should also be a sponsor.
Exactly. Pepto and Red Robin, give us a call.
Okay, back at Henry's home, Sean explains the situation he's in, and Henry gives him advice. Henry also awkwardly asks Sean to see him on Saturday for a reason he can't reveal yet.
I have something for that, if that's okay.
Yes.
When I feel like I keep interrupting. But awkward class has to have been...
That's your job.
It's got to be a James improv, because it's so good.
It's so good.
And
so good.
And I don't think that was it. That could be in my brain. So I do want to, like, I'd love to give credit where credit is due. And Corbin in this scene, Corbin is talking so fast. I think I just wanted everyone, I think it was finally my chance to have everybody talk as fast as the screwball comedies that I grew up loving. But Corbin is unbelievable. Just flying through his dialogue. And the secret with Corbin, and you can take this, and it's not a drinking game, but you can notice it throughout the show, is you must always give Corbin some actor business to do. And so this time I gave him the cleaning stuff. And I remember we did the first take and Corbin wanted to be washing the dishes. And he's going through all this dialogue and all you're hearing is clang, 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 no, clang, no. clang, clang, clang. So I was terrified. I'm like, oh my God, I don't want to insult him. He's great. He's killing all the lines. And then I went back to the prop guys and I go, give me some soft paper towels and a spray bottle. And so it's like anything that doesn't make noise. And it was so great because I was able to shoot through the glass, Henry going through there. So it actually made for a way better scene. And with actors, it's important to like, what do they want to help them, to whatever they're, and Corbin loves business, mm-hmm. You know, and I'm sure, I mean, you guys all like, you don't want to just stand there. But I think with Corbin, the more business, the better.
He does it so well.
Yeah,
it's a good bit there. You know, someone did a side-by-side of James in Black and Tan and Corbin in the first movie.
I did see that.
It was so funny because I called it out in the last episode we did that I believe Henry is wearing the exact same outfit that Sean in the first Psych movie that Sean is wearing as his model outfit in Black and Tan. And someone did a side-by-side and it's crazy. It's the same hat, the scarf, the whole situation. It's great.
Oh my gosh. We have to see that. I have to see that.
I did love seeing. Yeah, I saw that on the tweeter. I loved that somebody
tweeted it.
The all powerful Maggie Lawson put out the Batcave call.
I ask the psychos for things. I'll say, like, find this scene. Yeah, they're the best. Okay, so back at the station, Juliet Lasseter and Chief Vic meet about having a party. They also overhear a news anchor on TV talking about the case Lasseter is currently working on. Sean and Gus arrive back at the museum, and a creepy warehouse worker in a wheelchair greets them. Sean notices there's a tripod outside again. Then a person takes it and runs off in fear. Turns out, this was very sweet. She's a film student. Gus flirts with her.
The shot where we're in Vic's office, and the news story comes on, and I'm trying to sort of, again, that word subtly, but not really subtly, catch the news story because I want to see if I'm in it. That comedy bit was so fun that you let me do that, the leaning back in the chair.
Oh my gosh, Tim, it was, remember what we did? We put the table as far back as we could because we were trying, it was so funny what you were doing that we were trying to give you the maximum amount of territory that you could push back to. So we got it all the way back to the wall, and it's just so darn funny. Every time you lean back a little further, and then you really forget how far you are. And I looked at the shot. I wish I'd put the camera up higher to make it feel like you were even further back when the reveal was you were on the side, on the other side of the room. But your tiptoe pullback of the chair, it's just magnificent. It's so funny. And that's what is, you know, people don't realize is like, that's something that, you know, it's not on the page. It's something that Tim thoughtfully thought, okay, how am I going to get this chair back? And just tippy, 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 tippy. It's magnificent.
And it's still so, Lasseter. Whenever you have, like, even these comedy bits, it's adorable because we see these sides of Lasseter still in his, like, Lasseter veil frame, whatever. But, like, it's very funny. It's these instincts we have as people we can't hide. And he's terrible at it. He tries so hard. So
Maggie,
cute.
there's also a sort of a sub runner, I guess what you call it, of Juliet loves to throw parties for people under any circumstances.
Oh my God,
it happens
so
throughout
true.
The show at Lasseter when she invites all the criminals over to Lasseter's house. I think you're so excited about planning and how you're going to do it. And it's really sweet and fun.
And for a while, there's even in that episode, oh my gosh, it was Andy's episode, Homicidio, where I harass a female cop because I'm so desperate for friends. So I think there's also that element too, where it's like, oh, people, friends, let's have a party.
It's the great dichotomy of the character that she she believes I need to be, I have to put my whole self into this and everything to be the best possible cop of all time. But at the same time, she's yearning for a life outside, you know, and it's
totally,
and how do you balance it? And it's really wonderful to watch that whole journey happen throughout the course of the show.
It's fun. That's also like kind of a Maggie thing too. I wonder if you writers picked up on. I was always like, let's do mafia night. Let's all hang out. Let's all go to dinner together.
There's definitely a cruise director aspect to you.
Yes.
There is a cruise director.
And also coming out of that scene, by the way, is the other obvious first-time director thing where you go into the television and come out of the television in another look. I was doing all the obvious things. I had to get all of the shots in.
But they're great. Like whether it's I that's what I thought when Tim first brought up the scene he was going to say. That's why I went like that, because like the shot going in, the shot coming out, it's very good though.
And that reporter is standing in front of that door that used to be right near your trailer, Tim. That door that is like, it's like two steps, but we play it for City Hall all the time. And whenever it was right on our lot. And she's standing 16 inches off the ground, but it looks like she's at the top of the stairs, giving the whole backdrop of of the case. And so it's really funny. Like, oh yeah, we must have done that.
Yeah, I love, this is great. I didn't even know that. Okay, I'm going to go. Okay, so we have the film student now. Watching her footage, they notice a mummy in the frame. Gus runs out immediately. Sean then notices the car lights on the van, meaning the mummy drove away in it. Sean and Gus then begin to chase the van after Gus's incredibly long 11-point turn, psych first, I think, and the beginning of many, and one of my favorite bits of the show, runners of the show. Always. It's so good.
Yeah.
With a strange turn of events, the van goes off-road and hits a tree. Gus and Sean sneak over, flashlights and bats in hand, only to find the mummy inside, no suspect. Sean claims he can solve both cases at the same time. Turns out the warehouse worker in the wheelchair teamed up with Lassiter's perp to commit the perfect crime, except not perfect because they got caught. Back at the station, gifts are sprawled out on the chief's desk. But the best gift she could receive is the call from the mayor explaining she's no longer the interim chief because she is the official chief.
I got an objector, sorry. Psych first. The woman who comes in, sticks her head in the door and says, phone call, chief. It's the mayor. It's our dear Peggy. Our great background performer, Peg.
Oh, got, love got a Peggy. Line. Love Peggy.
Peg's first line on the show, which was really exciting to see.
Peggy worked with us for years. Like worked
Eight
with
years.
Us the whole season or the whole show. And she was so sweet. The just the warmest, loveliest person. It was very good to see her. It was nice to see her.
Yeah, it was so great to give her words.
Yeah.
She's just like she just brings a smile to your face on the set, on a set that has nothing but smiles.
Yeah.
And there
yeah, exactly. She fit right in.
And the great thing is, in that small little recap that you did, Gus and Sean bail on each other twice. Like Gus with the pullback when the reveal on the video, the whole shot of the chair spinning, and Gus has already ran out of the room just watching it on video.
So good.
Was really fun. I actually was really excited because I wanted the chair to spin. So I think I went in there, spun the chair and then sprinted out so it would still be spinning by the time Sean turned around. That was
movie magic.
And then we flipped the script and we had Sean leave on Gus standing next to the van, which, by the way, that van stunt, as we call it, a van was driven by our stunt coordinator, Dan Shea. And Dan Shea was also the guy who ran through the woods who you can't see running at all in the frame.
Yes.
So Dan Shea, you know, is all over this thing. And the fun thing about that spot, that exact spot, is where the MacGyver cabin is, where we shot one, maybe two ways out. It was mm-hmm. Right behind it is where the cabin, the same cabin that Despero gets shot in Extradition 2. It's the 50 feet away from where they dig up the body in the last episode, or where they go to the site at the very end of the breakup. So that we spent so much time on that little road because
so many memories.
Yeah, it was easy access. So that's your GVRD breakdown for the thing. And also, there's pineapple of the gifts that the chief is receiving in that final thing. That's where I saw the pineapple.
Yeah, me too. That's
apparently
where I
there's
it was
another
be.
One that we have to look for. But that's very exciting.
So that shot in the woods, Steve, you as the director and producer, think of all the other places, all the other times we shot there. I had the afterthought, damp, cold, and wet, and a long drive home.
It is such a long drive home, and your trailers are so far away, and it's a tough spot. But that spot in particular, you're on this road that goes on forever, and all of a sudden you just turn off, and that's actually the moment, the place where the van actually skids off. And you go down this little road, and there's a little cabin there, and there's a perfect amount of space to shoot everything.
Yeah.
You could shoot an entire episode within a 50-foot radius of this area. And, you know, of course, yes, it's cold. I do love shooting in the woods, even the daytime, nighttime, wherever it has to be.
It is cool. And like I said, it's authentic. You know,
yeah,
you're not
exactly.
on set. You're in it.
And by the way, another piece of psych trivia. I'm sorry, there's too much psych trivia, but
no,
but,
never.
The girl
enough.
Plays Hannah, the film student, is Ali Liebert, who's a hilarious actress.
She's so good, and I it's so funny because I'm like, wait, I know her.
Yeah,
I forgot she did the show.
When we were writing Psych the Movie 3, I was thinking when we were writing Bryn, the character who we ended up, of course, getting Katie Finley to do, I was thinking it was an Ali Liebert type. And Ali, it turns out she was in another country doing another movie, and much more important than our thing. But fortunately, we got to use Katie again.
She's great.
But that was such a fun scene to do. And in the back, there's a poster of a movie that says Center of the Universe, which was actually one of the first long form video I ever did in film school. So super double inside baseball right there.
Oh, the psychos are going to go crazy. They're going to love that and go back and watch it to find it. That's really cool.
Now they're going to go find that on YouTube.
Yeah. We'll get a screenshot.
They'll never find it on YouTube.
That sounds like a challenge, Steve. You don't know these people.
Did you guys hear that? Okay, wait. Let's do the last scene because I have a question about this.
Okay.
Back at Henry's house, he pines for Sean's attention on a certain secret subject, but Sean avoids it. Attempting to leave, Sean answers the door, only to be greeted by his mom. Fade to black. End of season 2. Okay. Was that just a cliffhanger? Did you kind of know, like, she's appearing immediately? Oh, because we pick up, don't we?
Yeah.
We pick up right away in season 3. Yes.
Yeah,
so good.
Yeah. And I have to apologize again, and I'm good at all these apologies, by leaving these cliffhangers, because as actors, when we shoot 16 episodes, you have a long amount of time to come back. And when it stops at 1 second and starts again, perhaps you would like to change your hair once in a while in your life. And all of a sudden it's like, nope, this picks up three minutes later. So everybody is beholden to go back to whatever, which gets us into wigs. Or if you do another show, if you color your hair.
Yeah.
So this one, I would always pitch at the end of the season, if I could, I wanted to go on a hiatus and grow a big Lassiter epic king's beard to come back the next season. It's like Lassiter's gone Serpico. It never worked out because the next season always started the second that the last season ended. So
well,
I never grow
I
my
love
big beard.
That though.
Tim, I told Maggie earlier, I was just on another podcast and they also had to split that one into two episodes, like my last psychologist podcast. So my goal now is not to talk so long that you have to split it into two episodes, but to go for 3, which has to be like the record somehow.
We love it. We love it.
Okay, you still be walking a mile and a half.
Yeah, tell us.
There you go. Exactly. Okay. So we should also talk about that Sean has fishy when he's in the psych office.
Yes.
The one thing that Kirsten took from the set at the end of the series, and Kirsten's phone conversation. I mean, a lot of this episode to me was rooted in this, the whole idea of the screwball comedy, the talking fast and all that stuff. Even the dead guy is named William Wiles, which was mm-hmm. named after William Wyler, the director from the 30s that no one remembers. It's really cool that, you know, these little things here. But Kirsten on the phone with the mayor is the traditional variation of, you don't say,
uh-huh.
hang up. Yeah. So what happened? He didn't say. But for her to have to do the whole one side of the conversation and her okay. And when she accepts the job, it's just like, okay. And I didn't do justice to it. Please
it was pretty
go
good.
Back and watch what she says, because it's really just super subtle and very funny in an episode of people talking super fast and doing all kinds of screwball things and running away from mummies. It's really, really good work. And, you know, I don't need to tell you guys that that our cast is amazing and the people that put on the show are amazing. But
starts with you, Steve.
Well, you know, and it goes to all of you. But the most amazing capper to all of this is, you know, that mummy room that it houses it. We had to build that because we couldn't find the space to fill it in the actual Museum of Vancouver. So we built that on stage. And once again, I hope it's Eric Norlin. I think it's Eric Norlin who's a genius, but I believe that set was built all by him. And it was great because I needed to shoot straight downs to show that we worked so hard to keep Gus out of the beginning of the story, just so he could walk in and discover both the fact that his name is not on the super paleo sleuth placard
and that he
will yeah. not go into a mummy room.
It's
and
so good.
It was so great. And what we did at the very end of the last day of shooting is Richard Coleman, our AD, who is a tremendous musician and will use any opportunity for music to be created. We set up a stage and we played a show in that set.
In the space? That's
surrounded
right.
by the sarcophagus or the snuffleophagus, as James calls it, in the episode. And it was tremendous, and it was just such an exciting, fun way to end the second season. And here we are on our soundstage with this unbelievable set that we've done, that all of our cast members have come through, and it was just a celebration of like, wow, we should do this for six more seasons and possibly six movies.
Yeah. I think that is exactly what was happening. That manifestation was happening. Also, that was our, from that point forward, I think, that kicked off the mini concerts we'd have for
yes.
our either half rap or like mid rap or rap parties, where Richard always performed, Marco would perform, we'd all get up and sing, Steve would perform. Like, it was really, really special. And you guys were so, I mean, so talented anyway, but it just was... I think that really sums up, you know, I think a lot of times people are ready to, they rap and they're out of there and they want to leave. You know, it's, and I feel like for us, we're like, no, we got to celebrate. Let's keep hanging out. We just always wanted to keep hanging out.
Well, and the fact that, you know, when we do 16, we'd start in April, we would usually end October. Sometimes we'd bleed into November and then we were dealing with snow or whatever might happen.
Yeah.
The fact that it was that cold and the weather had turned so much to have everybody stick around to the end, because it's just a good time and it's good people. And where else? What other show does a Patty Simcox reference from Greece?
I wrote down Patty Simcox. I was like, it's so funny.
Greece is the answer to this very, very personal trivia question with me. It's the first movie that I ever watched in a theater. And then turned around and went right back in the theater and watched the next showing.
I totally believe that. I feel like it has like fun. There's like the period, the time frame element, the musical element, the fairy tale element. Like it's funny. It's a show. It's such a performance. It's big. It's a very, I could totally see that. I love
yeah.
that.
And what you didn't realize when you were a little kid. First of all, there's oh, sure, there's a lot of problematic things in that movie when you watch it.
But with any movie.
What you didn't realize is that all of the high school students were 37 years old in that movie.
You do when you get older, though.
Yes, exactly.
And when you're younger, you don't know that. But as you get older, you're like, holy hell, these people are like older than...
Like Olivia Newton-John was a senior that year, sure.
Sure. Okay. Fan questions.
Oh, fan questions. Let's do it.
Quickly comment. Steve, I love how much in this episode you've referenced the screwball comedies, because at heart, I always thought this was a Preston Sturges production.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. It's and just the best. Love that sort of approach to it. And, you know, and we walk the tightrope a lot, but with the screwball comedies, they really walk the tightrope because it can fall apart at any second. And when you hit it right, it's so exciting. It's like having injected into a part of your body. By the way, let me just say for the record, never done before.
Same.
No intention.
Same.
Nor has the guy who apparently asked you that question earlier.
That is so funny.
But I just love it. I still remember the way you said, good God, man. I kept saying one more time faster. You go, good God, man. It was very dumb. Preston Sturges in itself.
That's so good. It's funny, you know, jobs I went on to after Psych. So I love the fast talking. I love all that screwball. I live for it.
Every time you and I got a chance to make it faster and funnier, we definitely embraced it.
Totally. And every show I went on to after Psych or after that, they'd be like, you can slow down a little bit. I'm like, wait, what? No, I like the rat-a-tat-tat.
Well, and we forced you into it too, because I mean, you know, I wrote a lot of words. Andy Berman loves words so much that he would actually change all the margins and shrink the font.
Amazing.
So he could get more words on a page. So you guys were talking, but it's, you know, what Andy writes is so fast and so brilliant that you want more words, you know, even when you're having to cut the little things out. But sometimes you're like, even in this show, I was like, okay, what?
Just like one of the strange side effects of my brain injury was I've had to overcome is I would tend to speak way too fast.
Oh, yeah.
Like I really had to work on pacing down my speech because I would just rattle through everything and no one would understand things. And then my mouth would not be at the same pace as my brain, like right now.
Well, you know what's so funny though, Tim, is like you talk at the same pace you've always talked at, which is such a testament to your recovery.
Yeah.
Is like you didn't never slow it down. This is to me, it's like I'm talking to Tim from 2009 right now.
Yeah,
he just happens to have a tremendous beard that he didn't have back then.
From cringing at the pump to getting an eye-popping check at your favorite restaurant, inflation is hitting us all where it hurts, and it really, really hurts. That's why I started using Upside. You guys, Upside is an incredible app for anyone who buys gas, groceries, or dines out. With every purchase, I'm earning cash back thanks to Upside. This app, you guys, is so easy to use. And I know that it sounds too good to be true. It is not. I have used it and it works. It is an absolute no-brainer. I can literally go shopping. I'm going to go shopping with all the money that I have been saving with Upside. To get started, you download the free Upside app in the App Store or Google Play. Use my promo code PINEAPPLE and get $5 or more cash back on your first purchase of $10 or more. Next, claim an offer for whatever you're buying on Upside. Check in at the business, pay as usual with the credit or debit card, and get paid. In comparison to credit card rewards or loyalty programs, you can earn three times more cash back with Upside. You can cash out anytime to your bank account, PayPal, or an e-gift card for Amazon and other brands too. Upside users are earning more than $1 million every week. That's probably why they have a 4.8 star rating on the App Store. You guys, this is no joke. You have to try it. Download the free Upside app and use promo code PINEAPPLE to get $5 or more cash back on your first purchase of $10 or more. That's $5 or more cash back on your first purchase of $10 or more using promo code PINEAPPLE.
Fan questions, hit it.
Fan question. Cybill Shepherd. Was Cybill Shepherd cast as Sean's mom when this episode was shot?
No, which is why I wanted to hint at Sean's mom at the beginning. So we had someone who was an extra there. And then the voice was not the person. I think it was just added after the fact. So we couldn't, because we don't want to give away in the cast, because they break down the cast and all that stuff. So we wanted to keep at least that secret. I don't know what value that has. Well, we want to keep something secret, but we did not know until the next year what we wanted to do. And I was working towards an end game, and this is going to be like a teaser for season 3, because I knew that the next episode, Ghosts, was going to be a little darker. What I was really working towards is Sean has carried all of this anger and blame to Henry all this time, and blames him for the dissolution of the marriage and for all that falling apart, and the reveal that Henry was the one the whole time who was trying to keep it together, and his mom needed to move on for her own sake, and that was going to change the dynamic of their relationship for the rest of the series. So we knew that the character was going to, once again, Cybill Shepherd, one of the greatest fast talkers of all time, yes. you know, not just Moonlighting, but with Peter Bogdanovich and all that stuff, that we, you know, she was obviously the top of the list. I named the character Madeline after, of course, Maddie from Moonlighting, thinking, no, we're not ever going to get Cybill Shepherd. So when we offered it to her, I was like, I should change the name. It's embarrassing that we're offering her this character that's also named Madeline. But I kept Madeline the whole time in there.
And that gets just called manifestation.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, I tell you what, you say you're going to do 8 seasons of a series out loud. It happens. I do believe you put things out into the universe. And
I do too.
Oftentimes they come back. But it was really exciting that, because so often, especially someone like Cybill, who's so funny and so prolific, that she's off doing something different all the time.
Yeah.
So the fact that our schedule is going to work out 6 months later, and that she's going to be able to come up to Vancouver, or want to come up to Vancouver to do, you know, a one-off, or as it turns out, a handful of them, is just, you know, it was just positive thinking. And there, you know, we had a long list of backups, and the fact that we got her was really exciting.
Amazing. One of my very first jobs ever in like 1997, I want to say, was I played her sitcom daughter on her show. She had a series with
Cybill.
Christine Baranski. Cybill, yeah.
Yes.
And she was on a show in the show, and I played her obnoxious sitcom daughter. So it was very cool to see her again. And she totally remembered, which was really neat for me.
Can we call on the psychos to find those scenes and
they're hilarious and sure. Yeah, let's find those. Oh my God, please.
Make it happen, people, please.
They will. Okay, what inspired this episode? Where did the story come from? These seem like they're one question.
Well, it's in my, once again, in the sort of dream list of worlds. It's always about the worlds. I knew I wanted to do a mommy episode. I love the Mummy movies so much. I love the supernatural. When I get to do a supernatural show, I would love it. And you know, and pretending to be supernatural has been the closest on this thing. But I love spooky movies, and you know, not the way that James does, but not to that level, because that's impossible to achieve.
Yes.
But I do. I really wanted to do something that incorporated like a fun, spooky story. And I love theme parks and museums and things like that. So the fact that, you know, later we're going to go into the aquarium, then the next episode I direct, maybe it's 2 episodes from now. I know I was directing 2 at some point a season, because like Michael English said, direct 1 the end of each season, and then I directed this, and I go, okay, I got to do 2. 2 is the minimum.
Yes, of course.
And at one point, I tried to do 3, and they're like, no, you can't. So because it was just, I had to be in LA at some point. So
April was like, this is a horrible idea.
Yeah, seriously, because it's, you know, prep, it's shooting, it's a whole thing. It's weeks and weeks.
Yeah, it is. It's, you know, but I finally got to come up and play. And this is the weird thing about having a show that's, you know, that's in Los Angeles. It's a show that like I created, and there's like a whole other group of people that are doing it in another country. And I would have to fight and fight to come up on just to be on the set for a couple of days. And I figured out with the directing, I had to be up there for two episodes, one episode for prep. And then for that, so if then I did two episodes, I'm up there for four episodes. And now I'm there a quarter of the time. And then I can come up during the regular time. So it's one of those things that, you know, you finally get to feel, you get to play, you get to be in the world. It's still, we had our own world down there in the writer's room. And, you know, and Andy is so hilarious and all the writers are hilarious and the post people are amazing and we're having a great time down there. But to get in there and to be, sit in a chair and to get to call action and to see you guys in process and to keep telling Tim, okay, you can do it a little faster, it's just glorious. So when you have your television show, all of you, make sure that you go up into the country where it's shooting, even if it's Budapest or somewhere, you know, in the on the other side of the world. Make sure you find a way to be there as much as you can.
I love it. Okay, we already answered this. Was the shot in an actual museum?
Yes, it was, but it was more of the Museum of Vancouver, which go to their website. I think it's MOV dot something.
Yeah. Okay, how long does filming take for an episode?
That's always was, we got 7 days and occasionally we would get eight. Remember
right.
When we get the eighth day and it would be so exciting and the schedule would come out and, you know, instead of 11 page days, which I think on the last podcast, the one that I haven't heard the one that isn't out yet or just came out.
Yeah.
But someone said, asked how many pages we do.
Yes.
And the record for pages, Maggie, was a day with just you and I. It was 14 pages. And we shot it in the rain in Chinatown. It came after the Yang episodes where Maggie was working in City Hall. Your story
I remember.
Yes.
Yes.
We had to shoot all of your scenes for this office. Sean and Gus come in and all that stuff. We shot 14 pages in one day. And in one of the most torrential rainstorms ever.
I remember.
And I don't want to say the torrential rainstorm made it that much harder, except for there were noises on the windows and from the sun. Because Andy Berman shot his polar bear episode in the worst rainstorm in the history of Stanley Park.
Yeah. Oh my God. That's right.
So James, of course, shot his found footage at Bigfoot episode. And also one of the great storms of all time.
Yeah, we were but that's, like, sinking. It was
yes,
very
but
funny.
Maggie, you hold the record. And it was primarily you. And it was, I think, the last day of that shoot. So
yeah.
Sometimes we get 8 days and the schedule says, oh, 4 2/3 pages for that day. And then five and actually not thirds. It would be eighths.
Right.
But then what happens is other episodes suddenly like, oh, we need a quarter of a day to shoot this thing for this other piece. And then slowly that day just disappears into, okay, you have like a morning you can shoot. So I think this one, we shot seven, but I think we had a little bit of an extra day to probably because of the GVRD and because we were exhuming bodies and all of that stuff.
Do you guys like shooting those long walking shots with lots of dialogue? That's a question.
That's a question for you guys. How do you guys feel? I love it so much, but it's so much pressure because you're 40 seconds into this amazing speech. You've been talking so fast and instead of door, you say floor and it's like cut.
Start over.
Well, and you're also walking behind a city cam operator who's got a million pounds worth of gear on his or hers hips and back. So you feel really bad when you screw up a line and you're like, sorry, buddy, back to the beginning.
No, I like the challenge. It's that fast talking thing again, too, where it's like, you know, I don't know. I like, it feels very dancey, like choreographed, like flowy. And so I don't know. I like, because when you get it,
yeah,
like it just feels so good, and you know it's going to look so cool.
Yeah, it is so much energy and so much excitement. I really loved watching that scene with you guys. And you know, it's like there's so much going on. Like, how is this 4 a.m?
Yeah,
Lasseter has had his coffee. What are you talking about? But the other funny thing too is what you can do if you have to is, you know, just put a camera way in the back. And so you can go to a long shot to cut, to tie it together. And then we did another thing where we put you a little bit, once it spins around and he finds the museum curator, we then have you follow a little bit behind. So then we can do a dedicated Steadicam shot of you that we cut to sort of when we need to cut something out or, because let's be honest, I overwrite everything. So you see, like, I don't need those words. You don't need those words. So you want to be able to tighten and trim.
Well, that's good because I tend to overact everything. So we're a great pair.
I love it. Do you guys have a favorite scene from the episode?
I think for me, it'd be Sean, James's reveal of the mummy and how the mummy got out of the snuffleupagus.
Yeah, I like that one too. Yeah, I probably have to say, I mean, I love the chief scenes just because of all of us there. And I love when we all get to be in a scene together and everything that's going on in those scenes. Steve, what's yours?
Well, I mean, of course I love the walk and talks. I love both of them. I love being in that 50s room with all the neon. I was so, so determined to put I had to put the fridge in there. So I had to make sure. And of course, it makes absolutely no sense that there is a fridge on display, but it's plugged in and it's operating. But that at least explained why nobody smelled the body after after that amount of time.
That's great.
I love that stuff. I love being in the Jeep. So much of this was just, it was such a joy to relive all this. And I loved James doing his impressive breakdown when he's doing push-ups on the side of the sarcophagus and in his recreation.
So good.
The 11-point turn was so fun because, you know, it was just an idea that we had. Like, see how long it can take to get out of there. And we didn't have a crane that day because probably we couldn't afford it. So what happened is we put Marco on the tallest step ladder we could at the very top of the loading thing. I was so terrified for him. He goes, oh, this is nothing with the big heavy camera. So that's not a crane. That's when you look at the way high shot that looks straight down, that's Marco holding on for dear life of that. And it's just really impressive. And yeah, Marco, you can't say enough great things about Marco and what he means to our show.
And as a person and a talent.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, who is the most superstitious in the cast? I might say me.
I know it's not James.
No.
James seems to want to test fate.
I mean, I'm very, very like, let's not jinx anything. I remember, you know, we've always talked about how none of us bought a place because we always felt like as soon as we would buy a place, we were on a good run of getting picked up. So let's just keep things as they are, whatever.
And Dulé and the pilot said, you guys should buy something here. We should buy something here. And none of us listened and we probably should have.
Probably should have. I don't know, Tim. Would you think that? I think I might be.
I mean, I know you lived. I remember you lived in a couple of apartments one time. They were kind of down on the, just down on the near the beach, where you were like, there was one apartment you had where it's like, this apartment's cursed. I got to get out of here.
See, I'm definitely very, very sensitive. So, but I'm also big like you, Steve. You were talking at the beginning of the podcast. You're like, I don't want to say anything negative because we don't want to start anything off on a negative foot, no matter what. Even though we might even cut it, you're like, I don't even want to say it. I'm like that too. Well, I don't even want to put it out there.
Well, and you know what's funny too? I mean, even to take that even to a more ridiculous level. When I was writing this episode, there was a Egyptian mummy show at a thing, and I'm like, I shouldn't go in here because what we're doing is. We've disturbed the grave sites of all that. And
that's so funny.
I was very nervous about it for quite a while.
Ooh, I see. That would totally be me. I would totally think the same thing. Well, guys, that's our episode.
Oh my gosh, that's it? There's no way we can split this into three.
I mean, we could. Yeah. I'm trying to think of what else we could do. Yeah. Should we just do our own drinking game?
Last week, in one of the fan questions, somebody asked what our model duo name would be.
Oh, yeah.
We were talking about black and tan.
Yeah.
And I was, I finally figured it out for the be blue and steel because of our eyes.
There we go.
Yes, Tim. blue and steel with black and tan. It's better than what I came up with, which I don't think was anything. What did we say? Beauty and the Beast? Beast and the Beast? Beauty and the Beauty? I don't know what we said.
I think I came up with Beauty and the Beast at the time.
Yeah.
I know to add to the black and tan, which I wasn't on, but my favorite word in that entire episode is the way that Melanie says dinner. She says it with, she gets the, she lets the accent fly on it, and it's, go back and watch it because it's totally delightful. It's the way I want to say dinner from now on. The only other things that I missed from my notes is I love the word smelt. And I love that they got smelting as much as possible. I love Gus's line. It says, now we got a mummy on the loose and the son of a bitch knows how to drive a stick.
that's great.
That was super fantastic. I love the night cycle run, the name of the cool girl's thing. I thought that was really funny. And this might be the origin of creepy Gus sniffing, because when he's sitting behind her and she pulls the hair out and Gus is doing, like, which to me is just always so funny. And the big problem for Gus's inability to find companionship in his life is probably based in the sniffing of it all.
Yes, I love it. That is so. That is that the fur? It might. I think that is the psych first. Maybe
it very well could be. But yeah. And then last thing on my notes was the nook and cranny conversation, which was once
so good.
James so rarely gets bogged down in anything, and he's like, you know what, we were making time, we're doing a great job. Richard, I think, was very happy, and he's like, you know, whatever I had written, it wasn't great, and so he said, look, we can fix this. So I literally told Richard, okay, we're going to shut things down for a minute, and James and I are going to stand in the corner, and we're going to come up with a new thing. And Richard was like, "Oh dear God, no! Who cares? Nook and you're discussing a nook and a cranny, and that's the level that James brings." You know,
I love it.
It probably felt like an hour and a half. I'm sure it was 3 minutes and 10 seconds before that entire nook versus cranny conversation was put together. But it was well worth it. And sometimes when you have your own television show, all of you out there, please make sure, take a moment. If it goes too long, stop. But take a moment, get the blow to the scene right.
This is very good advice. And you always did.
I say, even if you have Richard Coleman, your first aide, then standing there saying, we have got to go. Got to go.
We have to roll. We have to.
Just his very sweet British way of saying, go, 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 go.
Richard is the proper English gentleman and everything he does. And he does. Andy Berman, once again, does a great impression of him because Richard wants to get right to business and start the ball rolling right away. But he manages to reluctantly take the time, maybe not reluctantly, but he comes in and Andy does the funny thing is he comes up and he says, first of all, good morning. And then he goes right off into a run of it, but it's always to make sure you say, first of all, good morning.
First of all, good morning.
And then pleasantries are done. Yeah. And now it's off to business. And Richard has been our savior so many times, and especially being a first-time director again. There's so much going on and could have fallen apart and in so many ways. But I had you two there and an amazing cast in the cold of October of Vancouver, and just one of the great life experiences of my existence. And I'm so happy to be able to do it with you guys.
We're the lucky ones. We are the lucky ones. Steve, we love you. And we cannot thank you enough for all of this time and love and joy and excitement and all the tidbits and all the behind the scenes and all the everything. We are the lucky ones. So thank you.
I'm lucky. And thank you for being forgiving when I called the Golden Gate Bridge the Golden State Bridge, when I did not know any of the rivers around New York City, couldn't commit to a single one.
And or the bridges.
When you were saying the word Juliet, I called you Juliet. So there's three times where I went off the rails because I talk this fast all the time. But I'm so happy to be here. I can't wait to do another one. And I love the show. It's a lot of fun. And I don't think I missed an episode yet.
Oh, Steve, thank you.
We are incredibly lucky that you would give your time to come talk to us.
Yeah.
Always,
every time.
Always.
It's so fun because you have that still. It's as if it was like your first day on set again. And it was like our first, we get to relive all of this, and all of your excitement is just as it was then. And it's so fun because we feel the same way. So thank you.
Thank you.
So glad we got Steve to join us again. You know it's a good one when Steve apologizes for talking too much. We can't get enough of him. He like can't talk enough. More Steve. Anyway, thank you all again for listening to the season 2 finale of The Psychologist RN. Follow us on our Instagram at The Psychologist RN and our Twitter at Psychologist Pod. Oh, also please check out our Moment House live show this Sunday, June 26th at 5 p.m. Pacific time. We will be talking about the Psych movie, the very first Psych movie. Tickets are available at www.momenthouse.com/thepsychologistsrn. See you guys then.
This is The Confused Breakfast,
a movie podcast creating a lot of ruckus around the world.
We talk about classic movies the same way that you and your friends talk about them,
with a little bit of film buff knowledge thrown in because we just can't help ourselves.
If movie quotes are part of your daily vocabulary,
if you like to talk about fun fan theories,
if you've always wanted to punch a movie character in the face,
we're here to podcast for you.
From Back to the Future,
Ghostbusters,
The Shining, and so many more.
Check out The Confused Breakfast wherever you listen to podcasts.